Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello and welcome to this episode of GoTo Unscripted. I'm Charles Humble. I'm a freelance techie, editor, author and consultant. And this is part of a series of podcasts that I'm doing for GoTo, talking to software engineering leaders. Today we're joined by Mary Williams. Mary is an experienced CTO and leader of technology organizations, currently leading the technology team at Plio. They particularly enjoy helping others to level up as technical leaders and managers of organizations, and they work as a CTO coach and tech advisor to various companies in this capacity through micro-consultancy Chrome Rays. They have led teams ranging in size from 30 to 300 in a range of organizations from Procter & Gamble to the UK Government Digital Service, award-winning online print company Moo, mobile-first challenger bank Monzo, and patient-inspired AI-driven rare disease treatment discovery company Helix, amongst others. A published author and international speaker, Mary is the chair of a lead developer conference and a tech advisor for Kindred Capital. And as if that wasn't enough, together with their wife, they run micro-charity One Goes Up to help young women and other folks pursue STEM education and careers. Mary, it's so lovely to have you on. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really delighted to be here.
So maybe you could start by telling us a bit about your story. What got you interested in computing in the first place?
So I'm from a household that's not scared of technology or maths. My mum's an accountant, my dad's a mechanical engineer. And so very young, I would take things apart and try to fix them or find things that my dad had taken apart and not gotten around to fixing and then sort it out. I built my first computer from sort of parts of broken machines and so was a little bit of a hardware hacker as a kid. I was very lucky. I got involved in school with the local university's project to build South Africa's first satellite as well. So started off in the sort of electronics and hardware side of things and then realized that was in the 90s and realized that software was where a lot of the really interesting work was happening at the time. And so when I went to university, decided to study computer science, came to the UK to the University of Bath and basically failed to go home because my wife and I met at uni.
Oh, fantastic. That's really brilliant. So what was your reason for choosing to go down the management route? Because obviously if you started as a hardware hacker and a software engineer, that would seem like an obvious place to be. And then, you know, you obviously moved into management. So why did you choose to do that?
The honest answer is there wasn't a choice. Where I was at the time at P&G, there wasn't really a route where you could stay an individual contributor and continue to level up in the organization. And so really very early in my career, I ended up as a line manager. The first two direct reports I had were both older than my dad, which was a very interesting dynamic for us to navigate together. They were very affectionately known as Statler and Waldorf, you know, the two old men in the Muppets who sit up on the balcony and shout to everybody. I adored them, but they were wonderful to work with. But I remember them being very skeptical about this new idiot manager that they had, who was, you know, one in a long line of young idiot managers that they'd had. And they, until the first really, really major issue we had when I was leading the team, and they took me into a meeting room because it was all still in the office at the time and kind of went, this thing's broken. And I went, oh shit, that means that's going to be a problem, right? And they kind of looked at each other and then unfolded their arms and started having a proper conversation, solving it with me, because I'd at least understood the implications of the problem. And that was a new experience for them, I think. So yeah, I basically had to move into management because I was very ambitious and wanted to keep growing and keep moving up at P&G. And at the time, that they've changed this now, but at the time there was only really a move into management. And much, much later, you know, a couple of years ago, I found out I'm more autistic, and that made it make a lot more sense why I found it so challenging to move into management, because I think I found it a real struggle at first. And I'd had a couple of bad managers and really didn't want to be one. Didn't want to be a bad manager. I mean, I accepted that I had to become a manager, but didn't want to be shist it. And I remember just looking for any research and books and anything that would teach me how to do this well. If I was going to affect other people's lives, I wanted to be decent at it. And that's sort of how my management story started. Quite often people ask me whether I'd do anything different in my career. And the one thing I would have done very differently is if there'd been a route to staff engineer, principal engineer at the time, I think I'd have stayed in that kind of mold for a lot longer before moving into management.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? There was that period of time where, as you say, if you wanted to get more senior, then there was only the management route. Which is interesting. You mentioned there that you'd sort of read various books and things as a way of learning the skill of being a manager. So were there particular books you found helpful or books that you would recommend now?
Yes. I mean, PeopleWare is one of the sort of classics of, the people side of software. My favorite management book, which I appreciate is a very nerdy thing to say in and of itself, is First Break All the Rules, which is a book that came out of a huge study that Gallup did trying to find the highest performing teams. But it reads very much as here's a way to have happy humans who enjoy their work. And so it's got a set of 12 questions that predict high performance. And the 12 questions, of course, is far too much to remember off the top of your head. But I also like Dan Pink's Drive, where he talks about purpose, autonomy, and mastery. And those 12 questions fit quite well as into that sort of framework of purpose, autonomy, and mastery. And the missing bit, I think, is inclusion. And so that's the sort of recipe for creating environments in which great work can happen that I've been using for most of my career.
Yeah, the Drive book had a huge effect on me as well, actually. It's one of those, it is a real, it's a classic for a reason, I think. And PeopleWare too, actually. There's some really good stuff in there still. When you're sort of building on that a bit, when you're managing a team, how do you match people to roles that suit their intrinsic motivation?
Yeah. And so my favorite of those 12 questions I just mentioned is, do I have the opportunity to do what I do best every day? And I think that's a fantastic question, but it's also a really interesting way of staffing a team. If you start with what's everybody's individual superpower, what does it add up to? And then go, okay, well, in this team, we have a spike of brilliance on this and on this and on this. What's missing? What do we need to find? And I think it's probably one of the real, even today, current challenges of management is how do you cast people in the right roles and how do you let them get the best out of what they're great at and not spend all their time, leveling themselves out to be mediocre by working on the stuff they're terrible at, but instead going from good to amazing. And so one of my favorite things to do is there's a retro format which asks what you liked, loved, lacked, and longed for. And I've used that as almost like a career coaching exercise with a number of people now. So helping them reflect on what they really enjoy about their current role, what are they missing from it, and what do they not just miss, but really, really ache to do more of. And that's a really useful sort of framework, but also a very useful discussion to have with somebody, I think. And so I've tended at an individual team level to do those kinds of conversations and then try to form the picture of what the team's total capabilities now are. And then staff accordingly, if there's any gaps at all.
I love that. I've not heard of that before. That's I think that's brilliant. What a fantastic question to be asked as well. I was wondering if you feel that the skills you need as a manager have changed as technology's got more and more central to organizations.
Yes, I think, in terms of, we've got remote working much more now, we're collaborating across countries and borders much more now. I remember having a team when I was early in my career at P&G. I had a team that was partly in Manila, partly in San Jose, Costa Rica, partly in Newcastle, and partly in Cincinnati, which already is a very weird combination of cultures to try to get something out of. The sort of default answer from the US is always an enthusiastic yes, and the default answer from Manila and San Jose is a very cheerful yes. But possibly not completely clear on what's being asked for. And then the default Newcastle answer is a very cheerful no. I remember having to adjust my style to this reality that, you know, the no from Newcastle meant we've got to talk about this. And the yes from Manila might have meant we should have talked about that more before we agreed to it and those kind of things. So yeah, I think that in the in modern management, being able to lead people who are different to you is really important, and not just from a, you know, diversity and inclusion point of view, but from reality that you're going to have a load of people who are from different backgrounds and different countries and languages, and, you know, not just the languages we talk to the computers in, but the languages we talk to each other in as well. And so I think that ability to flex your style as a manager and as a leader has become increasingly important. I also think that leading has become more important. I think if you dial back 20 years, management was a lot of telling people what to do, and usually people who were doing the same job you used to do, and it hadn't changed that much. And I think the reality these days is many of us are leading people and managing people who are doing jobs that we've never done. Whether that's that you've never been a system reliability engineer, or you never developed things for iOS or for Android, you know, it's very common to be an engineering manager or leader that has people from different subdisciplines under you. But I think it's also increasingly the case that you shouldn't be telling people what to do and how to do it anyway. You should be enabling them to figure it out themselves. And so I think we've moved from this very directive, authoritarian kind of model that's proven not to work as well, right? There is not sufficient context for you to be right about exactly what people should do and how they should do it all the time, into a much more creating the conditions for success kind of approach to things. So crafting that environment in which great work can happen, I think, is a different thing than what a lot of people assume management is. When they think of a manager, people still think of the pointy head boss in Dilbert, who's, you know, clueless and useless and practices the seagull style of management, you know, flies in, shouts at everybody, shits on everything, flies away again. And that's not a successful mode at all. I mean, it never was. That's why it's funny. But I think it's even less appropriate than it was 20 years ago.
Yes, and I think that distinction that you were making there between management and leadership is a really important one. So maybe to pull on that a little bit more, what are some of the other qualities you think you need as a leader?
I actually think there's so many different ways to lead, but I think I like the axiom of, you know, strong beliefs or strong ideas loosely held. So having an opinion but being willing to change it based on data and other people's input. I think increasingly leadership is about influence, and I don't mean in the Instagram influencer way, but in the how do you help people understand where you're coming from and try to get them to see the challenges that you're seeing and to rally around them. And so I think there's an element of sort of having a vision. There's an element of being able to engage others and to influence others. And then I think increasingly for technologists, there's an element of commerciality. I think we, for a long time, had a lot of technical decision-making and technical strategy almost in isolation from the rest of the organization or the business. And we just can't afford that any longer. We're not in the boom times where you can say, well, yes, the business needs whatever, but technology is different. I think we're part of the business and part of the organizations in a much bigger way now.
Yes, 100%. Actually, that's something that I've always found that distinction between the technologists and the business weird and unhelpful. Yeah. You know, it's like, how do you think you get paid? You know, like, it's just, I've just always found it very odd, but you're right. It's been there for a long, long time. Yeah. There's another sort of thread that I want to pull on from something that you mentioned there. And it's something that I've worked through a few times in my own career. And it's those kind of inflection points. So like around 100 people is a classic one, where suddenly you go from an organization where everybody knows what everyone else is doing to an organization where that's no longer true. And a lot of times, you know, all of our systems and processes break down and we kind of have to remake things. And it's as a as a founder or a CEO, that's a really uncomfortable situation because suddenly it's like the nature of this business has changed. Now, given your experience with both larger organizations, but also rapidly scaling at GovUK, I was wondering what advice you have for people in that sort of situation.
I think the primary advice is look for somebody who's 12 to 18 months ahead of you and take their advice. It's very easy to look at the Googles and Apples and Netflixes and Amazons of the world, and they, you know, they share a lot about what they do, and it's very interesting. But it's always so funny to me when you've got a, you know, 100 person or 300 person organization and they're going, but Google does it this way. I'm like, yeah, what did Google do when they were 300 people? Let's talk about that instead. and I think, you know, looking for guidance and advice and mentorship from the right people at the right time, I think is really important. There's this desire for when you hit that 100 or 150, which is sort of Dunbar's number as it's known, point, there's a desire to sort of fix it and then never have to worry about it again. And I don't think that's realistic. I think as you evolve, you get to new inflection points, the bigger that you get as well. And I think what a lot of organizations end up with is, you know, roughly 100 to 150 people, units that then can know each other and trust each other and work well together, that then are sort of replicated and grouped together in different ways. And that's one way to do it. But yeah, remember that those inflection points are going to keep coming. You don't get to redesign your processes once and then never worry about it again. You're going to have to keep an eye on these things, and you have to sort of care about how you do the work almost as much as the work itself in order to stay nimble and to react well to those changes in circumstances.
Yeah. There's a related thing that I've seen happen, which is where the culture of an organization sort of breaks down. And it can happen even in situations where organizations have been very deliberate about their culture and, you know, try to hire to values and promote values. And I think it's sometimes anyway, because organizations will sacrifice culture maybe for efficiency, or maybe they stop sort of repeatedly communicating what the values are and what's expected. Is that maybe another reason? But do you have any kind of thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a famously Enron's values were something very aspirational, even whilst they were destroying everything, right? I can't remember whose quote it is, but there's some quote about, you know, the values aren't the big posters on the wall. They're what you do every day. The standard you walk past is the standard you accept, I think, is the military version of that axiom. I do think that it feels very HR-y to articulate your values and hire against them and to use them when you're managing people to check that they're acting the way that you want them to act. But you kind of have to, because if you don't, then you're not holding people to the culture. You're not holding people to the standard. And so I think you have to integrate it, not just in your hiring, but in your ongoing management of people, in your ongoing leadership of people. You have to be like, even if you're a leader who gets a lot done, if you're an asshole to everybody, that's not acceptable. You have to be in line with our values as well as effective is an important message. But I think it too often becomes quite bland at the point that people try to translate their culture into values. I think you want those values to still mean something. You want somebody to look at them and go, yes, that's something I like. I actively want to be a part of that. Or no, that's not for me. If that's how decisions are going to be made, I don't want any part of it. You've got to be opinionated enough for people to opt in or out.
Yes, I really agree with that point. And I think, and yes, it's difficult. I mean, I worked at one organization where on the exec team where we went through the process of trying to sort of codify what the culture was. And it's really hard and it takes a lot of time. And one of the reasons I think you can end up blandifying, is that a word? We know what we mean. End up with a bunch of sort of meaningless platitudes is because trying to get a bunch of people to agree what the culture is in retrospect is actually really hard. But if it's working, it starts working as a filter. If you get it right, then it, you know, like these are the things we believe in, and therefore if you don't believe in these things or these things don't fit, then we shouldn't be doing them or we shouldn't have those people. And I think that's really important. I actually wrote an article on that, which I will try and link to in the show notes if I can find it. But I think it's a really interesting aspect of that, because obviously sort of values have such a terrible reputation. We all kind of imagine, you know, a bunch of executives going off on an away day and picking some words out of a hat, like, you know, innovation and customer focus or something. And yes, those all sound like things we agree with. Go on.
I'm a very strong believer that values should be verbs, not nouns. Because I think as soon as you can articulate it as an action you need to take or a behavior you need to show, it's immediately so much stronger than when you just have a standalone noun like innovation or integrity or honesty or, you know, cool. But like, what do you really mean? I think what you really mean comes out when you say, you know, we value honesty and kindness tells you a lot more than just like honesty on its own or those kind of things. Like, you know, be kind and fair is a much better instruction than just fairness and kindness alone, if you see where I'm coming from.
100%. That's a very good point, actually. Absolutely. You touched on this a little bit already, but I kind of want to pull on this again a little bit. So you talked about this thing of looking at the large tech companies, the Amazons and Googles and Metas and the like, and kind of trying to replicate what they're doing when you're a 100-person company is probably not the way to go. And I mean, it's kind of top of mind for me because I've spent a lot of the last decade of my career in what is effectively IT journalism. And in IT journalism, you know, you tend to focus on the new stuff and the big successful companies because that's essentially what people want to hear from. But I think sometimes it's kind of unhelpful if you're a startup or a scale up. You know, trying to replicate Google is probably not the way to go. So I just wondered if you could, you sort of said a little bit about that already, but I wondered if you could kind of expand on that point a bit.
Yeah, like I said earlier, I think the sort of 12 to 18 months ahead of you is the example to look at, and you're actually much more likely to find that amongst sometimes your competitors, sometimes your peers, other folks who have been invested in by the same investors that you've got. I see a lot of those sort of investor communities are quite interesting now. CTOs from different businesses that they've invested in talking with each other, even if they're different industry, it can be really, really, really useful. I also think that there's just a need to figure out what problem you're really solving, which I think is just generally good advice, but is especially good advice when you're in this sort of scale up journey, because there are so many things to fix. There's so many opportunities to make things better, but which of them are going to be the most impactful, and how do you do them in a way that you know what impact you've had? I think it's very easy to end up with messy experiments where you've changed too many variables at the same time, and then you don't know when it works or doesn't. You don't know what caused the failure because you messed with it too much. Yeah. And it's very tempting with people stuff. It's super tempting to just change everything, and very difficult then to unpick what the outputs and outcomes are. So I think that's interesting. I also think that there's just a lot of the ways of working that, you know, the complexity you're dealing with is so different when you're in a thousands or hundreds of thousands of person organization. And when you have the level of customers that those kind of organizations have, you know, you can move a button and it will be a multi-million pound decision if you're working on Amazon's homepage. I don't think that moving a button is anywhere near as impactful if you're a 100-person startup. Like, you wish for the world where moving a button could have that kind of financial impact, right? And so I think the other thing that happens with these big companies is that it becomes more and more worth them investing in tiny, tiny incremental changes and tweaks and improvements, where when you're earlier on, you know, you should be focusing on product market fit and building something that will, you know, stand up if you are successful. You don't need the resilience that Google needs. You don't need the kind of complexity that a lot of these organizations have to deal with, because you're not at that stage yet. And you can get so swept up in trying to emulate all of these things that you lose track of what really matters, which is, you know, who are your users, who are your customers, what do they need, and are you able to give it to them? Are you helping them be better at what they do? Kathy Sierra wrote a fantastic book called Badass, which is all about how what we should really be focused on is making our users more awesome, whatever it is that they're doing.
Yeah.
And I think it's very easy for us to lose sight of that, particularly in tech. We get focused on what the tech is and how it works and how it's all fitting together, and forget that it's fundamentally just a tool. And if it's not the best tool, it's not going to do the best. So we have to do better at those kind of customer needs, user needs, making sure that we're really deeply understanding what someone's trying to achieve, and then figuring out the best way to help them be a part of it. One of my favorite examples of just how thinking needed to be turned a bit upside down when I was at WK, when I was helping build that team out, was there was a web page that showed the public holidays in the UK. Mm-hmm. And somebody went, you know what? Probably most of the time somebody comes to this web page, they just want to know whether Monday's a bank holiday. The most important thing, the most important information is, when's the next one? And so they redesigned the page and put, the next bank holiday is Monday, blah, blah, blah. This, you know, whatever the next one is. And we measured success of that part of WK on how quickly people went away from it again, which is a very non-classic website metric to have, right? Most websites are like, I want to capture you and keep you as long as possible so I can show you ads. And actually for WK, we were like, actually, the longer it takes someone to find an answer they need, the less productive the country is. So actually, sometimes we want them to bounce really fast because they found out what they needed and they left. Yeah. And that's totally fine. But it was a very different sort of way of measuring success, and a very different thing to think about, was this kind of like productivity of the nation and whether you were wasting people's time by telling them things they didn't need to know or making them search in a page for the information that was most relevant to them. And it taught me a lot about success metrics and how to think differently about what you were really achieving when you were designing those sort of behavioral metrics.
Yeah. I also think that's, I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but I think there's part of that as well is trying to either talking to your actual customers or at least trying to sort of be empathetic and think about what they might need. I have a vaguely parallel story from a retail banking project that I worked on years and years and years ago, where it was two banks. I won't name them because I don't think I can, but they were two banks that had sort of merged, but they'd ended up with two separate mainframe systems. So if you had, you know, like a current account and a savings account, they could be on two completely different mainframes.
Yeah.
And the way the call center worked, so you pass what's called ID and V, which is basically when you ring up and you do some security. And while that's happening, what's going on in the background is your details are being loaded up. So your details are loaded up to these two green mainframe screens. And then the person at the call center could basically flip between the two screens.
Yeah.
And the thing with that was it had a learning curve like a brick wall.
Yeah.
Because it was just two pages of like incredibly cryptic acronyms. Mm. And so they asked my team if we could sort of, you know, redesign it and webify it and make it really pretty, which we did. And it looked amazing. And then we took it into the call center and they hated it.
Yep.
They absolutely hated it. And the reason was because, yes, the old system had a learning curve like a brick, but everything was in one of two places. And once you'd learned it, you could answer every question and go through a call really fast. And that's the job. And what we designed was very fast to learn. But once you learned it, it wasn't particularly quick because it had to keep going and fetching stuff. And it's just a really good example of, you know, like, oh, I was thinking about this problem completely wrong, which I just think it's a really easy trap to fall into.
I had a very similar example when I was early at P&G, where we replaced a system that was largely just the previous approach was a very, very complicated set of interconnected spreadsheets, and replaced it with something where it was very easy to learn and very easy to navigate with a mouse. But everybody who were, they were essentially doing data input, and so they were immensely frustrated with it being so slow. Once we'd made this sort of nice UI, it was terrible for them because they couldn't keyboard shortcut to the things that they were used to. And we had the same when I was at M&S. We built the app that customer service agents would use. And what a lot of people who are longtime M&S customers do is they ring up and they know the item codes. So they're reading out of a catalog or similar. And they want to just read you all of the item codes and then you to add all of those things to their basket, because some people are still shopping that way. And we had a huge problem because, you know, you could only search for one thing at a time. And so the most impactful thing that team ever did was to make it so you could put in 12 search terms and it would deliver those 12 search results rather than making the call center agent do them one at a time, which was just an incredibly frustrating experience for them and for the end user who was trying to be there. So yeah, it happens so frequently, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I love the way this bit of the conversation has gone, because I think so often we spend a lot of time focusing on the positives, and you're clearly someone who cares a lot about being a good manager and doing the job well. But I think so often actually the things we learn from are the mistakes that we make, but we maybe don't always talk about those a bit. So with that in mind, are there things you've got wrong, you know, along the way as a manager that might be worth talking about or sharing?
Hugely. I mean, I definitely, one of my biggest mistakes as a young manager was just completely misreading a cultural difference. It was someone who everybody around and a lot of the feedback for them was that they came across as really arrogant and they weren't listening to other people and these kind of things. And it was actually immensely insecure person who, and it was all bravado. And I didn't see it. I couldn't see that that's where it was coming from. And so my coaching approach and my feedback approach was completely wrong. Broke them rather than helping them. And I regret it to this day. It was really, really unhelpful that I didn't spot earlier that the sort of underlying reason for their behavior. I am very proud of having been at Monzo, but I think I really, really messed up at Monzo for most of my time there. I came in and was worried about the wrong things, couldn't understand that it was a organization that didn't have budgets figured out yet. So they were just like, if you find a good engineer, just hire them. And I was like, but what? Huh? Like, we have to have some sort of plan for how many we need, don't we? And I think I was a little too early for the stage that we were at, because I know myself quite well now, and I'm good at the point where you know how to make money, and now you need to do it faster and better. And I think the earlier stages than that, I'm not as good at. I'm just not as good at the finding product market fit and the exploring your way to a great product. I'm good once the road is, you know, the direction is clear, and now it's about going there faster and fast and efficiently. That's much more my speed. I joined Monzo at a point where we were still kind of figuring out how to make money and how to. We were great for customers, but weren't necessarily great from a unit economics point of view. We kept thinking that we were unit economic positive, and then turning out that we hadn't factored in this part of customer service or this cost or whatever. And I think I annoyed the hell out of Tom Blom when I was there, because I was just the whole time searching for structure that didn't exist and wanting certainty that didn't exist, and not able to deal with that. It actually led me to discovering that very late in my career that I'm autistic and ADHD, so doubly neurodiverse. But partly it was because I struggled so much in this environment where there wasn't the sort of structures and guidelines and guardrails that I was used to having, whether that was, you know, budget or profit or, you know, super clear strategy or whatever else.
Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Something else that I seem to be spending a lot of time arguing with one of my clients at the moment, so I'm going to throw it in, is around onboarding. Because I have this idea that heavily investing in onboarding is a really good thing to do. So again, I was just interested in your perspective on that. Do you agree with me? Am I talking nonsense?
I agree with you very wholeheartedly. I think it's one of the highest leverage things that you can invest in, not least because we, you know, in the labor environment that we're in, we have, you know, 3 to 6 months. You don't really get longer probation periods than 6 months, and that wouldn't be appropriate to have somebody unsure of themselves for that long anyway. But the shorter you can make the period of onboarding, the better chance you have of seeing how somebody really performs. And so it made a massive difference. Monzo, where we went from it taking, you know, 6 to 8 weeks for people to be fully productive to getting it down to 4 weeks, just meant that you got 2 full months of performance to assess when, you know, in their first 3 months. And that was insanely valuable for us, especially when you've spent so much time recruiting. You really want to have a clear view of whether somebody's going to perform well once they're in role. And making mistakes at probation is so much more risky and so much more devastating than making a mistake hiring. Mistake at hiring, it's okay. If somebody doesn't work out, they almost can leave it off their CV and never speak of you again, right? But if it takes you 6 months to figure out that somebody's not a good fit and they're not going to perform, then a series of 6 month stints on your CV, I don't think is good for anybody. Doesn't look good, doesn't feel good, it isn't positive for the organization because they've invested so much in getting somebody up to speed and then found that they are not going to be able to stay and contribute. So I'm a big fan of investing in onboarding. I love it when you can have people join and have something in production in their first, ideally their first day, but worst case their first week. I think it's really important. And so I think that's worth investing in your processes and your CI/CD and those kind of things for the technical aspects to be easy and your environment set up on your dev machine and those kind of things. But it also just pays off so well in the health of the organization over time, provided you're adding enough people. I think if you add, you know, one person a year or, you know, whatever, there's probably some percentage of change in staffing that I haven't figured out what the exact number is, but there's definitely a number where it's then immensely worth investing in onboarding. But a lot of people don't realize they should have invested in onboarding until a year after they hit that scaling inflection point where they should invest. They only realize a year later that, oh shit, we had half the team that were less than 6 months in role, and it takes 6 months to get useful, so we had half the team weren't useful. That's a terrible situation to be in.
Absolutely. I want to change tack a little bit. I'm curious to ask you how you feel about DE&I, given what's happening in the tech world at the moment. And I slightly hesitate to ask this question, really, but
I mean, I joke that I'm the one the Daily Mail warns you about. I'm an immigrant with a job. I'm a woman. I'm seen as a woman by a lot of people. I'm non-binary, but, you know, I'm disabled and I'm neurodiverse and I'm queer and my wife is British. I'm over here stealing your women and your jobs, right? I'm the devil in incarnate. But I grew up white in apartheid South Africa, so I'm also very aware of unasked and undeserved privilege. I had all these advantages that because I just happened to be this kind of pale, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's incredibly important that we still are representative as a industry of the people that we're serving. We can't build great products and great companies if we don't understand the people who are going to be our customers. And as long as those customers are a wide range of people from all different backgrounds and cultures and creeds and everything else and genders and whatnot, then we have to represent that in order to build great products. And so I think it's particularly for tech so important that we don't go along with, you know, the devastation of inclusion that's happening in the US right now, that, you know, where it's very, very worrying and, you know, on a historical scale, worrying what is happening right now. But because I've just seen it play out in my career so many times. When I was far before I was at Monzo, there were some early engineers at Monzo who were trans, and they shared with the security, you know, their peers, how shit it was when somebody called them by the wrong name or by the wrong gender. And Monzo, to their credit, the person who led security and identification and those kind of things went, well, that's crap. Surely we can figure out a way around that. And Monzo to this day is one of the few banks that will never call you by your dead name, will never say what's your real name. We'll always just, sometimes they need a document that might have a different gender and a different name on it. And they just go, cool, can we get your official documentation? And then tell us what you want us to call. you want to be called, and we'll make sure we never get that wrong. And I think if those early engineers hadn't been there and hadn't felt safe to share and hadn't talked about it with their colleagues, it would have been another bank that just is an awful experience for trans people. A much simpler example was when we started working on savings at Monzo. There was one engineer who was a bit older and had kids who were, you know, doing their A-levels at the time. And she was the first engineer who could explain to the others why you might want to lock your savings up, because everybody else was, you know, 24 and a half and didn't have any savings. so it was like, why would you need a fixed term account? Why would you lock your money away for 12 months? And she was like, well, because it's for my kids' uni. They don't need it till they go to university. So why wouldn't I lock it away to get a better rate on it? And it was almost funny how much of an aha moment it was for the other engineers in that situation. And so I just continue to think that we have to be, particularly tech, because we are comparatively such a small group of people who then build things that such a huge group of people use. So that, you know, it's the model of what we do as an industry. We have to be representative of those people in order to build the right thing for them. And continuing to only have teams that are white or are, you know, Apple Watch famously, when it first came out, didn't work if you had tattoos or darker skin. The pulse, etc. features didn't work. And we just shouldn't be in a world where that can still happen, where you can get something all the way through to being launched and, you know, out in the world, and it not work for whatever, 80% of the population. We are a global minority, whether we want to think of ourselves that way or not, and we just have to get better at this stuff. So I think there's a lot of fear and uncertainty and dread at the moment, all about the whole DEI topic. But equally, you wouldn't guess it from the headlines, but 60% of companies are spending more on DEI this year than last year, and we're just not having that conversation at all, because it doesn't fit with the rhetoric that's coming to us politically.
And I think it's such an important point to make. Actually, I see this a lot, that a particular narrative takes hold, and then anything that doesn't fit the narrative we don't talk about. But actually, so often the narrative is wrong. You see a lot of environmental stuff, which has been like a big area for me for the last couple of years. And you know, if you just read the newspapers, you assume that everything is terrible. But actually, everything isn't terrible. Real progress has been made and continues to be made. And things it's not terrifying. It is. But things are much better than I thought they were a couple of years ago. But we don't talk about that, which I think is just to our detriment, really. So I think it's really important to bubble those sorts of things up. I do have a related point, which is that I've seen organizations that put an unreasonable level of pressure on the minority folks within them to fix stuff. So yes. I was just wondering if there were particular like anti-patterns that you'd seen in the context of DE&I that we should be aware of.
Yeah, I mean, a huge one is assuming that the people who are affected are the ones who need to change, when in reality, you know, racism isn't coming from people of color. I mean, so sometimes there is racism between different groups as well, but you know, the day-to-day problem is a thing where white people mostly are who need to change how they act and how we behave and what we do, right? And in the same way, sexism isn't women doing things against each other. and so I think you're right. I think it too often is a second or third job for people in those minorities. And so I think one part is it's good to have ERGs, employee resource groups, or, you know, active communities, or there's a load of different terms for them, but they have to be supported and they have to not have a load of work put on them, that the answer to every question they ask can't be, oh yes, why don't you do that? But it often is. You know, early in my career, led the first LGBT network that P&G had outside of the US. And I remember there being, we had to put the world map off Wikipedia with LGBT rights up for people to understand that there were still more places where we would be put to death than where we could get married at the time. This was in, you know, 2002. And it made a whole bunch of people realize that actually maybe this was a work-related thing. there were a lot of people at the time who were just like, why do you want to talk about who you sleep with at work? We're like, that is not what we want to talk about, for the record. But you want to send me to Singapore for my next assignment. And Singapore literally has the death penalty under Sharia law for people who are queer. I don't feel safe being sent to Singapore for a few years. And we have to have that conversation in my career chat at some point. It's not a choice. You want me to go to Cincinnati for an assignment, and I'm perfectly happy to do that. But America doesn't recognize my marriage to my wife. And so I'm going to have to leave her behind if I go to the States. That's a work-related thing. We have to talk about it. And so I do think that, on the one hand, you know, you get people who are passionate and they want to bring that passion, and we owe them protection against burnout and to make sure that we're putting our money where our mouth is and really taking on that work collectively. So there's this sort of nothing about us without us saying in the LGBT community has. And so I think consultation's really important, but putting all the work on those folks is not the right thing to do. But it is very common that that's the case. And it can happen despite the best of intentions, right? If you want to make sure that every engineer is interviewed by a woman, but you've got very few women in your team, you suddenly, as a woman engineer in the team, start to feel like you know, half your job is interviewing because you're who the people team calls on every time. Right. And that's not, you know, that's coming from a good place. We want to make sure we don't hire anybody without the opportunity to spot if they're really biased against women, because sadly that's quite common in the engineering world. But you don't want it to become half the job of somebody who fundamentally wants to be technical and wants to be building things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really insightful. Thank you. I want to say we're coming towards the end of our time, so I want to change tack a little bit. So you're currently CTO for Plio, but you're also an advisor to a number of companies. You're chair of a lead developer conference and so on and so on and so on. So what is it you like about having lots of different roles at once?
So I think my ADHD diagnosis shouldn't have been as much of a surprise as it was, is the honest answer. Looking back, I was pretty sure I was autistic because I'd managed so many autistic people. I was like, yeah, there's some definite similarities here. And then the ADHD diagnosis was completely out of left field for me. But I remember taking the meds for the first time and telling my psychiatrist, like, I didn't know my brain was noisy until it went quiet. You know, my brain is 100 open tabs at all times with no choice about which tab is in focus. And the meds let me choose which tab is in focus and lets the others fade into the background. And it's a very interesting thing. So, but I think where it came from originally, just doing lots of things, and I've always done lots of things. When I was at school, I was playing sport. You know, I played hockey and water polo, and I did athletics, and I did theater stuff, and I did, you know, computer club and whatever. And I think something in my makeup means that I always need something to be urgent. And if you're busy, if you do enough things, then something's always a priority. Something's always urgent. And if you're very urgency driven rather than importance driven, which is quite typical when you've got ADHD, it's a lot easier to just have a lot on and then trust that there's always a deadline for something. Something's important in one of my many things at any given moment. And that works well. Advising Kindred, which is the VC I advise, I've particularly enjoyed because I've gotten to meet so many and see so many different companies in their journeys and see them as they scale. And that's been super interesting. And then I've in more recent years started doing board roles as well. And that's to some extent a bit of a retirement plan, I suppose. You know, that it can be a successful strategy to start doing a series of board roles rather than a full-time exec role. Although every time I head in the direction of doing fewer things and you know, consulting a bit more rather than taking a perm role, I then miss having my own team. So I'm terrible. I tend to go back and forth between being perm and being a consultant quite regularly and quite predictably almost. But yeah, I think in retrospect, it was all about just needing to have things be urgent all the time and being busy enough that something was always urgent was successful for me. I learned very early how to context switch very, very, very efficiently. And so I've always been able to go from, you know, one thing to 1 minute between meetings and I'm on a completely different topic and it's totally fine. It doesn't discombobulate me at all. And I think that's been a useful skill too.
Do you have any other advice around that sort of work-life balance, balancing what's presumably a very demanding CTO role with all the other things that you're doing. How do you do that? I mean, I've been a CTO, and the idea of being a CTO and doing literally anything else would be totally beyond me.
So the one thing is that because of the disability I've got, I work a 4-day week, and that really helps. So I have an opportunity to rest, which helps a lot. I also just very early in my career got used to doing sort of quite long days. And so I'll do a normal day at Pleo, and then I'll have an hour or two in the afternoon, in the evening where I'll do other things, whether it's the advisory roles or assessing new companies or the conference stuff that I do. But I think the overall work-life balance has been positively impacted by me realizing that just doing nothing wasn't very restorative for me. So I have found that for whatever reason, I need to do a thing that is restorative rather than trying to just rest. And so video games, building really complicated Lego, whenever I'm in the sea, whenever I can be. I love snorkeling. I love underwater photography, mostly because if I take a camera with me, then I can pay attention underwater for much longer, because I get focused on taking photos of things rather than, you know, experiencing it as just being in the water for a very long time. And so, yeah, I love scuba diving as well. And so that's been the big unlock for me, is this realizing that I needed some sort of active restoration rather than just to not do things. And trying to just not do things when you've got your brain so busy with really complex and complicated and challenging problems, which is what a CTO role is very much like, is important. So, because I think I used to just go, oh, I'm exhausted, I'll just watch TV for the day, or I'll try and read a book, or I'll whatever. And I was just, my head was still worrying about that meeting on Friday, or that executive presentation I've got coming, or this board presentation that's coming next. And so, yeah, figuring out what active rest and active recovery looked like was super important for me, and has made a huge difference. But I've done my last four CTO roles as 4 days a week, and that's been transformative for me. But as I say, partly as a sort of disability adjustment, and partly because I've just found that schedule works much better for me. But I don't think I do 80% of the role. I think I do 100% of the role for sure. I just do it in a slightly different way. Yeah.
I'm genuinely kind of blown away by how well you seem to know and understand yourself as well. It's just like I don't know how to put it. It's just like, it's a really unusual thing to speak to someone who just has such a clear understanding of this is what I need and this is how I work. And I just find that kind of mind blowing.
To be honest, some of it has been forced. Over about 13 years ago, I got a disability diagnosis where I've got something called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and all my joints dislocate, which is very painful and not very fun. And I wake up every morning with dislocated joints and have to put them back in place before I can get up and do anything. And that was horrific at first. And I tried to just keep missioning through it. And I used to work horribly long hours, and I was humbled by it. It broke me. And I've had to learn all of that stuff, and had to learn how to be effective and how to be successful despite having a body that kind of betrays me a bit. And so I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but it certainly teaches you a lot about yourself when you hit a brick wall and have to adjust to it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. One last question. What are the things that excite you most from a technology point of view at the moment?
I think everybody says AI. I'm excited at all of the messes I'm going to get to clean up because people think AI can do all their coding for them now. I made a career out of dealing with legacy. I joke sometimes that I've dealt with so much, you know, with legacy older than myself. It was so legacy, it was vintage. And I think there's going to be a lot of tech debt that's produced in the next couple of years because we will put code in production that we don't fully understand because it's been written by an LLM. And so I'm excited about some of the side effects of the current AI craze in a weird way. But actually, I think that how much cheaper and greener computers becoming is going to be very exciting. I don't think LLMs are going to lead to generalized AI for a variety of reasons. I'm from an AI background, so I have quite strong opinions about all of it. But I do think that there's going to be some real upsides to us making technology much, much greener, much lower impact on the planet, both in terms of initial production, but also in terms of ongoing running and maintenance. And I think if Gen AI gives us one thing, which is immensely cheaper and greener compute, then I think that might be a really good thing for the long term, for the planet and for the industry. So I'm quite excited about that. I'm excited that we're getting better as an industry at management and leadership. It's part of why we started Lead Dev. I talk about it sometimes. It's a leadership conference disguised as a technology conference. We've always had sort of three themes, which are team, tech, and tools. And it always looked like they were sort of equal themes, but really the team bit was about 50% of the time and the rest were a little bit less. And it's been wonderful to see that community grow and not just because the conference grew, but the community around it grew, because there's now just so many people who don't just want to be forced into management and be terrible at it, that actively want to be good at it, that realize that they can be multipliers. They can, you know, helping 10, 12 other people be the best they can be is actually a really rewarding role. It's not quite the same dopamine hit you get from all your tests passing and pushing something to production every, you know, multiple times a day. It's a much longer reward cycle for developing somebody and getting them promoted or getting them a new job or seeing them really excel. But it's still really exciting. And so I continue to be heartened by how much better we're getting as an industry at the management and leadership side of things as well.
Marie, that's a brilliant place to leave it, I think. Thank you so much indeed. It's been an absolute joy to speak to you. It really has been. Thank you so much.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.